unite and work together if we're all going to get through this.
Sounds like socialism to me.
The amount of people I see talking about socialism positively is actually staggering.
Do you think, do you really think that a proletarian revolution is just around the corner in America?
If Bernie Sanders were president, right, and he wanted to bring the same ideas as socialism into this country, do you think that we would benefit?
Yeah.
But I just told you Venezuela is eating rats.
But I just want people to have health care.
The problem in Venezuela is not that socialism has been poorly implemented, but that socialism has been faithfully implemented.
The ideas of socialism, that the means of production, distribution, and labor should be owned, controlled, and regulated by the community as a whole, are the worst sort of collectivist ideas which exist.
And we believe that everyone has the right to be unequal.
Do you call yourself a democratic socialist? How can any kind of socialist win a general election in the United States?
Well, we're going to win because first we're going to explain what democratic socialism is. And what democratic socialism is about is saying that it is immoral and wrong that the top 0.1% in this country own almost 90%, almost as much wealth as the bottom 90%. That it is wrong today in a rigged economy that 57% of all new income is going to the top 1%. That when you look around the world, you see every other major country providing health care to all people as a right, except the United States. You see every other major country saying to moms that when you have a baby, we're not going to separate you from your newborn baby because we are going to have medical and family paid leave like every other country on earth. Those are some of the principles that I believe in, and I think we should look to countries like Denmark, like Sweden, and Norway, and learn from what they have accomplished for their working people.
Capitalism is good because capitalism is freedom. Socialism is bad because socialism is tyranny. Not it's an aspect of tyranny. Socialism itself is tyranny. Socialism itself is tyranny.
Welcome back to the Sensible Socialist Podcast. Today we're going to kick off our second episode with a riveting bit of podcasting. Definitions. It's almost always critical to the success of any conversation that the words we use in the course of that conversation are agreed to in advance. When you don't do this, at least it's been my experience, It just makes for all manner of understandings. You talk past the person you're talking to. It breaks conversations down quickly. People get caught up in this or that thing that you did or didn't say, or that they misunderstood what you meant when you used some word. So this is nowhere more difficult than on the question of socialism. Here's just a quick example of what I mean when it comes to being able to define socialism for yourself.
In your opinion, is socialism a good thing or a bad thing?
I mean, I think people kind of throw that word around to try to scare you, but if helping people is socialism, then I'm for it.
It could really benefit our country in the future.
I think it's a good idea.
Socialism as a concept, as a philosophy, is good. I think that it's got a bad rep.
Trying to spread the wealth is definitely a good thing in America, and it's definitely a thing that's needed.
There's a lot of things with social welfare that I think would be good to have.
Do you have a positive reaction to socialism or a negative one?
I'd say a more positive one. I'm definitely more open to it.
But we should have a standard of living for all people.
Okay.
Just by default, that should just be available.
If we did it democratically, then we could really incorporate socialism.
Like, it definitely seems like a more feasible option, and it could help more people. Like, just as a broad term, it could help more people.
How would you define socialism?
I mean, honestly, that definition gets thrown around a lot. I'm not exactly sure.
How would you view what socialism is, though? Economically, what is socialism?
Economically, I'm gonna think about that for a second.
I guess just specifically just, you know, getting rid of that wealth gap in the United States.
How would I describe it as little words possible?
How would you define socialism?
I mean, it's definitely more of an open form of government, and it feels like a lot more accessible to a lot more people. And that's kind of how I see it, like being more accessible and more kind of like equal ground. Yeah.
What does that mean necessarily, though?
To be quite honest, I don't know.
The bad rap that the students mention in that last clip, it is the perfect ground for this little gem that I found.
So, what is a socialist? Well, it's someone who typically believes that productive resources are the property of the government, that the distribution of goods and services are administered by the government, and any remaining private production or distribution is regulated by, you got it, the government, not free market. But how does that differ from a regular Democrat? Well, Democrats typically support a strong federal government with powers to regulate business and industry for the public interest, as well as federally funded social services and benefits for the poor, unemployed, and the aged. But a Democrat opposes government regulation in citizens' private lives. Craig, did I get it right between the difference of a socialist and a Democrat?
Yes. Yeah, you did. The textbook definition, as you said, between a socialist is the state owns the means of or controls the means of production and distribution. Of a communist, the state owns the means of production and distribution.
All right, so while that guest claims that the host got it right, did she? So few people either even know or could even agree on what that nine-letter word actually means that I think this is probably the best way to think about the so-called normal usage of the word.
Now, as far as socialism is concerned, that term has been so evacuated of content over the last century that it's hard even to use. I mean, the Soviet Union, for example, was called a socialist society, and it was called that by the two major propaganda operations in the world, the U.S., the Western one, and the Soviet one. They both called it socialism for opposite reasons. The West called it socialism in order to defame socialism by associating it with this miserable tyranny. The Soviet Union called it socialism in order to gain whatever, to benefit from the moral appeal that true socialism had among large parts of the general world population. But this was about as remote from socialism as you can imagine.
I think that's exactly right. And the problem is that these words still carry a lot of power. And for many still, even the notion of being labeled a socialist or thinking of America, you know, quote-unquote going socialist, evokes fears of Soviet invasions a la Red Dawn or the setting up of some new gulag archipelago. I've heard this very thing from friends and from family that, you know, I shouldn't use the word communist because it has such a bad connotation. You know, socialist, I guess, is getting a bit of a rehabilitation. It might be okay, but like, oh, don't call yourself a communist. Given all of this, it seems of paramount importance to start this podcast by giving the students that we heard and the Fox News listeners and just everyone a chance to hear a simple breakdown of what some of these words that we'll use a lot on this podcast, what they mean. So with that, let's jump in. I do want to make a bit of a disclaimer. These are not, I'm not using anyone else's definitions. I'm incorporating a lot of different things from even things that you can find on Wikipedia. But basically, I'm not trying to be highfalutin or ridiculous. I just want to define some words in a way that it makes sort of sense and doesn't take a degree in philosophy to understand. So you might disagree with them. If you do, great. Let me know, and we'll have a discussion about it. I would be happy to talk to someone who has a lot of different ideas about what these words even mean, because I think that that's important to talking about it intelligently. So let's just put that as a disclaimer. So you might think that, given what the podcast is called, that I would just start off by defining socialism, but I'm not going to do that. Instead, I'm going to start very basically, and then I'm going to move up the ladder to sort of more complex ideas. I think a lot of these things sort of build on each other. So if you kind of lay the groundwork, and it takes a little bit, it's not, hopefully it's not too boring, but it takes a little bit of time. And then once you lay it out, then you can get to socialism. And I know a lot of people might be antsy, oh, what does he mean by socialism? But I promise it's worth it. So just follow along with me. At the outset, I did hear from a friend of mine about my use of the sort of term social justice warrior in the first episode. And I thought, this isn't really super groundwork, but I just thought I'd address that right away and say, I use it to mean the person who, they have the right intent, they are fighting for oppressed people in our society, of which there are many, and they are fighting for justice on the social question, you know, that being the relationship between the different groups in society. But I think the methods, the sort of thing that I mean when I say social justice warrior, somebody who has the right intent, but whose methods, things like shouting people down, not letting people speak, and deplatforming, or even, you know, up to violence and things like that, that not that there isn't a role for violence at certain situations, but that when the situations do not warrant it, and they have an effect that basically is counterproductive and it tends to alienate more people than it recruits. So that could be like these Twitter mobs, the people sort of constantly asking you to sort of check your privilege and things like that. I mean, I think that it's important to understand the dynamics in society, don't get me wrong, but I think this notion that you have to abide by certain ideas and norms and not challenge them, otherwise you get labeled as some terrible people and you can be dismissed. And I think that that's a very, an intimidation. And that's not the way. If your ideas are powerful, they will win. And I know that sounds very sort of liberal and whatnot, but I really genuinely think that these ideas that we're going to talk about on the podcast are ideas that can win. And so that's kind of what I mean by that. I hope that makes a little bit of sense. So I want to start off by talking about political economy. So political economy is the study of production and trade and their relationship with laws, customs, government, and how that relates to the relative income and wealth of a certain given society. So right away you might have thought, well, that sounds like economics, and then the second part's like, well, that sounds like political science. And in general, you'd be right. The thing is, political economy is a single thing. You can't really break it up into two things, politics and economics. And that understanding of the invariable link between those two things is an important philosophical position that has to be understood. It communicates the understanding that in the real world, economics is political and politics is economical. These two things are so wrapped up together that an attempt to depoliticize economics or de-economize politics is in itself an expression of the interaction between the two, because it's usually providing cover for something illegitimate on either side, or maybe even both. So political economy, it's very important. The next thing is Hegelianism. And I know that seems like a jump, but in order to understand Marxism, and Marx was a political economist looking at the relationship between economics and politics, you have to understand Hegel. And Hegel, George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, was a German philosopher, and he influenced like the whole of Europe, but in Germany in particular, around the time of the French Revolution and like the Napoleonic Wars, sort of the turn of the 18th and 19th century. And he was a sort of rationalist, absolutist, idealist. So he thought that the real is rational, it can be understood through philosophical inquiry, and it sort of rests on the capital I idea. This capital I idea can be used then to like understand history. So it's history is the progressive expression of an absolute idea that's within human beings and has its expression in human culture and politics and society, but that it's an idea. It's a notion in our head that we can come to philosophically. And the way that it does that is that it's through a dialectical method, which it sort of emphasizes the contradiction of things and claims that there are inherent contradictions of these non-absolute ideas. And that serves as the determining factor in the interaction between things. And there's like three stages of development. There's a thing, the thesis, and it has internal contradictions. And so those internal contradictions give rise to the antithesis of that thesis, the sort of opposite, the expression of its opposite, its expression of a contradiction. And then those two things interact. The tension between them is resolved by means of a synthesis between the two, and the each side will have its still its own contradictions, and hopefully the interaction will negate that contradiction, produce a new synthesis. But if it's not an absolute idea, we still have another antithesis. And so we continue on with the dialectic until we reach, for Hegel, the sort of end of history, where the where you have a true expression of the absolute idea. And this Hegelian idea of the dialectic moving through history, and you can understand history through it, was incredibly influential on a lot of different people, but most famously on Marx himself. And so Marx, even he sort of said this, and many have said this, that what he really did in his philosophical sort of work, or what differentiated him philosophically from Hegel, was that he turned it on its head. So he uses the dialectical method, the thesis, the antithesis, and the synthesis. But you don't look at it through the expression of this idea or absolute idea, but it's through the material conditions in the society, in reality. And so there's a dialectical nature to history. It's not the unfolding of some idea, but the material conditions of societies at different stages of historical development. And those different stages of historical development and in technological developments produce contradictions in societies that have interactions. And it's not that ideas sort of shape history, but it's the material forces in the societies and in cultures that really play the central role. And, you know, Marx explained that to understand history is to see it by way of what the productive model is. Who produces? What do they produce? How do they produce it? What's done with what's produced? And if you examine that part of the society, you can really see how history has really moved. And it's not the only thing. There are a lot of other things that go along with it. But if you really look at the basic way that history has moved, it's through this material interaction and progression towards, not necessarily towards something, I mean, I think Marx might have said that, but towards, but in a way in which there is some kind of development, that each time you lose more and more contradictions, and that helps get closer to something that can really be like the absolute idea. So when you examine the parts of the society, what you realize is that as soon as we get into human civilization, the one central thing develops, and that's class. That the history of the world can be understood by this class relationship. Who has what? What do they do with it? Who controls it? And Engels, which was Marx's contributor, described how, you know, the history of humanity can be roughly divided, and I think, you know, anthropologists will have different opinions about this, and this is very, very simplified. But there's these, like, big stages of human history. There's this, like, primitive communism stage where you're sort of hunter-gatherer and maybe early, like, pre-civilized kind of no real classes. You have this egalitarian sort of system. And then you develop agriculture, and you get slave societies, you know, Sumeria, Mesopotamia, Greece, Rome, China, Indus. I mean, a lot of different places in the world had the structure of a sort of slave societies where you had a number of different slaves captured in war and different things like that, not necessarily the chattel slavery that we think of in the U.S. And then you have the development of sort of feudalism, and that's societies organized like large-scale agricultural and done based on sort of monarchies and nobilities, hereditary systems of control of large landed estates. It develops into a sort of capitalist where you have this private ownership of means of production, and then finally a communist one where that same production is owned and controlled by the community. And so this dialectical materialism is, it's sort of a rough shot way of understanding it, and I think that it'd be useful to have an episode just to talk about dialectical materialism, because I think it's a interesting idea philosophically, and that was a very quick and rough introduction. So the next thing I want to talk about is the means of production. That's something that you'll hear a lot. You already sort of heard it in one of the clips at the beginning, but like the means of production, it's a simple concept, really. It's the things that allow us to make other things. So factories and computers and machines and warehouses, cars, software. I mean, everything that you can think of that's used to make something or do something that somebody wants, that's in demand. The sort of importance of this idea, this means of production, is that it's really important, and I'm sure you've guessed, who owns and controls it. It's paramount to the idea of understanding how the dialectic is working. Who's owning it? Who controls it? What is the relationship that the different members of the society have to how things are produced? And understanding that, you can really realize a lot of different things about the society and understand how it's changed and why it's changed. So, you know, who owns the means of production has changed over time. And that's because the mode of production, how and for what we do use the means of production, has also changed over time. That's usually because of an advance in technology. And so, as it happens, the social relations of production, that being like cultural and societal norms and values that develop around different modes of production, and the sort of members of society around it. What's so crucial about the idea of the means of production is that the relationship that one has to it really brings us to an all-important question, which is our next term, class. So class is, it's a confusing idea for most people. I mean, in the U.S., but around the world, we constantly hear about this notion of the middle class. Oh, the middle class is in trouble. We got middle class tax cuts or all this kind of stuff. And, you know, it's growing, it's shrinking, it's being squeezed, it matters most. Like Barack Obama constantly talking about the middle class. But if you ask someone, how do we know who's in which class? You know, usually people have this idea there's like this upper class, this huge middle class, and then like this working class, poor people. And the variation of the answer about how you know who fits in what class is about as diverse as the people you ask. I mean, everyone, it seems, defines class, if they define it at all, in some different way. And it's the result of an intentional campaign to distort what the word actually means. And you may be thinking, well, why is that? And it's like, well, it's easy to understand because what determines your class isn't your wage, your income, how much money you have, how much you can buy, anything like that. That's the kind of things that we're normally told. It's the relationship you have to the means of production. So do you own it? Do you control it or not? If you do own the means of production, then you have the power and the ability to direct the means of production and be able to do a lot of different things. And that creates power. You get profit and wealth, and that allows you to even control and change the mode of production. But if you don't own it, you don't have any power to determine anything about the scope or the scale or the purpose or the structure or the orientation of production. Eventually, you become a means of production yourself. I mean, people in this current system sell their labor, their commodities themselves, human beings. So the Communist Manifesto, which we're going to talk about in the next episode, talks about that, you know, the current mode of production, capitalism, has pulled a number of different classes. There's usually a genuinely a sort of have and have nots, but you'd have different people with different relationships and different roles in society. You know, like in the caste system in India, you know, it's not two classes, it's four. And so, but capitalism really just pulls it apart. And now there's two big classes, those who own and those who don't. And that brings us to our next term, the proletariat and the bourgeoisie. The proletariat and the bourgeoisie. We've heard these terms. I think everybody's heard, you know, the great proletarian revolution, or that's so bougie.
Bougie and ghetto at the same time. Bougetto.
But I think few of us really know what it actually means. So bourgeoisie is obviously, you know, a French word. And it comes from those who inhabited the boroughs of Paris. And those are, you know, former artisans who turned owners and managers of some of the first examples of industrial production in France. So these like large scale production of different commodities that a lot of people were using. And so these owners and managers, along with a new breed of like intellectuals, lawyers, doctors, still artisans, made up like a growing movement in France, particularly around the revolution in 1879, and before, that they kind of got lumped together and were called the bourgeoisie. And this group, this bourgeoisie, these owners and controllers of production in market-based systems, are the sort of leaders of the American and French revolutions, and then those in 1848, and they're sort of guided by Enlightenment ideas from John Locke and different people, and the ideas of like civil and political rights. So like the U.S. Bill of Rights, the French Rights of Man and the Citizen, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, those kinds of things. And life, liberty, property, that's what we're talking about. So this group would eventually, in all those revolutions, sort of take the place of the old ruling class of like monarchs and nobles and old landowners and those things like that through violent revolution. They chopped off the head of the king in France. We revolted in America from the king. There was a lot of killing of the old people. And it's still remembered as the sort of idea of revolution, and that's something that we do need to, in some ways, shake off, but understand that the way that the current ruling class got into power was quite, quite bloody. But while the new bourgeoisie was growing, there was also growing, just as the dialectic would anticipate, its opposite. This new industrial working class, former peasants moving to large cities to find a better life and finding it that they have to work in factories. And these are huge amounts of people that are coming in from the countryside and working in huge human-based production. These are the proletariat. So these two groups have opposing relationships to the means of production. The bourgeoisie own and control them and usually don't really work at them and just take all the profits. And the proletariat work at the factory by selling their labor and time for money, what we know of as wages. So eventually this system has replaced the old feudal system, large-scale agriculture by bonded peasants, kept in place by knights and lords and kings, and replaced it with a new system of industrial commodity production for profit, maintained by managed, nominally democratic republics, by and controlled by that same bourgeoisie. And they did so by accumulating capital. Capital is an economic term. The dictionary definition, I guess you'd say, is something like the wealth in the form of money or other assets owned by a person or an organization, available or controlled or contributed for a particular purpose, like starting a company or investing. Adam Smith defined it as, quote, that part of men's stock which he expects to afford him revenue, something that you can make some money with. And it's a pretty vast definition. But what I would use, what I would say capital is like close to what Marx meant. It's money that's used to buy something only in order to sell it again to realize a financial profit. And it's potentially something you could liquidate too. I think that's important. But it's only really capital if it's going to realize some kind of profit. So it only exists within the process of economic exchange. It's wealth that grows out of the process of the circulation of production and commodity consumption itself. So since capital is the basis of, and accumulating it is the goal of the current mode of production, we call that mode of production capitalism. Capitalism needs a simple definition. So capitalism is a system where the means of production are owned and controlled by individuals who employ other individuals to produce commodities distributed by markets for the purpose of creating profits. I think that's fair. The profits is the surplus between the price at the market and the cost of production. So the system depends on and comes and develops with the system, the large-scale industrial production. And so it rises as humans developed that technology that allows for electricity and large-scale buildings and smaller differences in transportation, all of these kind of connective trends of commerce that modern shipbuilding, the railroad, the steam engine were able to realize. And the system is incredibly productive, produces crazy amounts of commodity, and produces a lot of wealth. It raises the standard of living for the people around it. You go from these feudal, agricultural, decentralized kind of systems to very huge consumerism, for lack of a better term. And it has a fundamental flaw. And the fundamental flaw, I think, really is just the profit motivation. There's a lot of people who will argue for the profit motivation. You know, something about human beings won't do anything unless they're motivated by something. And making money is a human, is a the single greatest human motivator. And it forces people to always find better ways of doing things. It the competition between people lowers prices, usually because of the lower labor prices, because that's one of the only non-fixed things. The problem with doing this whole profit-making system is that you're doing it by selling the commodity at the market for more than it costs you to make it, which is to pay the people to make it. And so there's always a difference between that. And so you don't pay the people enough to buy the stuff they need, they're not going to be able to buy everything that you make. And if they don't buy everything that you make, then you won't be able to make a profit. And if you don't make a profit, you go under. And if enough people go under because there's some kind of other crisis, whether it not be financial through money manipulation, which is another whole aspect of it, there can be, and there are very often, crises. Constant crises. And so we call it, and we're taught to call it, it's the business cycle. It just goes up and down, and it always goes up and down, and everything is okay. But if you really think about it, this tendency to go into crisis is an expression of the fundamental contradiction. So if you're looking at it from that materialist dialectical lens, it's that expression, and it's produced an antithesis. The proletariat, the people that are always on the losing end of this quote-unquote business cycle. And it's because they have these diametrically opposed interests that they necessarily interact, and the interaction is class war. There's a constant struggle between these two, because we all know we don't have the same interests as the owners of where we work. And this time right now is a current round of that class war. And what is that class war going to produce? For Marx, I think he would say, and yes, we finally got here, socialism. But let's pause a second. Are we going to answer the big question that a lot of people have? What's the difference between a socialist and a communist? Now, I'm about to explain it, but we went over all the stuff we did just now so that this will make some sense. So you remember how people are defining socialism. And let's just take a quick look at somebody who has talked about this pretty recently, just to remind you.
Let's define socialism.
Okay.
How do you define socialism? So I know that we're agreeing on that premise.
Socialism is a system in which the state redistributes wealth from what it would be under a pure capitalist system.
Okay, I think we agree on that. Okay, so as we both agreed, socialism is basically a collective, a governmental control of the distribution or means of distribution or production. And when I say evil, I mean I believe that that is immoral.
All right, so that just gives you an idea as to what we're talking about. Socialism is the government control of the means of production and distributions, and it's morally reprehensible. In order to really get at why that's very, very wrong, I'm going to twist it around on you, and we're going to go right for the big word, the big bad word, communism. Communism is the mode of production where the means of production are owned and controlled by a single class, the only class in society, who through community control and democratic decision making, create a system whereby the commodities and services that are produced are distributed based on that simple motto, from each according to their ability and to each according to their need, meaning that all industrial and technological production would be engaged in, not for private profit, but for the general welfare of society and its constituent members. Communism is, in this way, the truest expression of that democratic principle that we all have. It uses democratic decision-making in all areas of our lives, from our workplaces to our schools, families, communities, whole economic sectors, and even larger. It doesn't force people to work who are unable or even unwilling. It doesn't demand that we all sell our labor and our time at jobs that most of us hate. It uses technology not to distract us and not to disconnect us, but to further liberate us from the shackles of meaningless and emotionally or physically dangerous work. It would end poverty, war, slavery, economic anxiety, hunger, and even in some basic way, fear. It's the necessary, though not sufficient, condition to end things like racism, xenophobia, misogyny, homophobia, and all of those other manner of social ills that are part of the social relations of this capitalist form of production, which is in some ways really based on this implicit or explicit threat of poverty or war or slavery or economic anxiety, hunger, and even in some basic way, fear, to motivate the vast population to work for wages that are usually not sufficient to purchase and are not sufficient to purchase the very things that they produce. So I know this might sound a bit utopian, but it isn't. There are going to be contradictions in the systems that we create. Nothing is, after all, perfect. The dialectic is going to continue on. There's no end of history, but instead the end of this class war chapter of human history and the beginning of the writing of the few first pages of that new period of human society, the one where we're liberated from the confines of that class war. In this sense, communism is, despite the propaganda that Chomsky rightly pointed out at the beginning, the true liberating potential of humanity. And it's hung above our heads like a building thundercloud, even raining on us periodically. And the sky's getting dimmer. But before we get to communism, we have to find a way to remake our society. It's not just going to happen because we will it to happen. And that, comrades, finally, is what I mean by socialism. If you want a little bit of a background on this, check out Socialism, Scientific and Utopian. It's a nice little pamphlet, not very long, and it's where Engels lays out the foundations of Marx's socialist thinking, the sort of scientific socialism as compared to a utopian socialism or different kinds of socialism. I've put the description or the link for the for that from Marxist.org in the description in case you're interested in learning about it. So, socialism. Socialism, honestly, simply, is just that transition period between the historical epoch of capitalism, as we've defined it, and communism, as we've just defined it. Socialism is that period of time where the means of production through various processes that sort of accumulate in this revolutionary event are wrestled from the hands of the few private individuals who really do own and control them and transferred into the hands of the workers. Socialism is like the final battle of this long-standing class war, where those two classes really have to fight it out for who's going to ultimately control the means of production. I won't lie, this kind of event or this period of time, they're very tumultuous when they've been engaged in the past. There was a transition period between feudalism and capitalism, and a lot of things, not always great things, happened in that period of time. And that isn't necessarily impossible. But we are in a new age, a new, more frankly, enlightened age. And so I'm not going to say that this whole process wouldn't involve some kind of violence, but it doesn't have to. And that's really up to the small number of owners to decide. You know, I mean, history's replete with examples that when workers attempt to do even taking over the means of production on a small scale, owners usually use violence to enforce their hegemonic control. So, look, in theory, socialism could be voted in. But I don't think that votes will ever really be enough. That it's only when we all get together and really understand that we do have this common relationship to production that we can unite against the people who have the other or a different relationship to the means of production. And there's only two kinds of relationships to that means of production. And it's really important for us to be able to realize how many of us are on the side of working and are parts of the means of production, and the few that own them and control everything about our lives. And that's only when we get together, you know, can we realize this new historical period of true liberty, and true justice, and truly for everybody, that I think makes socialism in some ways genuinely as American as apple pie. So let's take a break and realize how far this definition is from what influential media personalities will claim. I mean, at minimum, if you've gotten this far in this episode and you hear someone say the kind of nonsense that we've heard from all these different people, you'll have a pretty good idea that they really don't know what they're talking about. But what I do mean when I use socialist in the title of the podcast, what am I a socialist? Yes. I think that we've already in some ways entered and must continue forward with this socialist period of transition. Look, we've seen good and bad examples of it. We've seen, you know, partially because Wright was Marx about things and partially because he didn't take into account his own role and the power of his ideas to match that moment in history. But that we've seen amazing things happen under even the most deformed version of this idea. We've seen terrible things happen as well. And we've seen a sort of hybrid model, this, you know, social democratic welfare state that's come out of this interaction and has positive and negative aspects. But we've entered into the age of socialism. And, you know, there was a way of talking about it in the early 20th century that we're all socialists now. And I think in some ways we used to be. And I think we still really are. But, you know, you'll hear a lot, especially from a new brand of liberal intellectual like Jordan Peterson or even Sam Harris, that this sort of like perversity or destructivity or historical invalidity of Marx's ideas. And look, nothing like it is really the case. The sort of great irony of the using this quote-unquote Marxist lens, you know, sort of understanding dialectical materialism, is that the failure of socialist or communist projects in the 19th and 20th centuries can only really be understood by using dialectical materialism. Why did they fail? And what happened? And that's something that we're going to talk about on this very podcast. Look, without that analysis, you can make all sorts of wild claims about what Marxism is or isn't. And when you talk about the propaganda that's been used about it, no one knows what socialism is or isn't, or what communism is or isn't. And it's really important that we do. And hopefully now that you've listened to this podcast, you have a little bit clearer an idea of what it does mean. But look, Marxism isn't like a religion. You know, there are things that we talk about. We'll be talking about the Communist Manifesto next week. They're important to read, but they're not sacred. These aren't, you know, on chapter and verse of Marx, it says X, Y, and Z, and Lenin said this, and Mao said blah. It's not like that. Look, Marxism sort of bears the name of its originating theoretician, and the sort of underlying point of the dialectical method is to realize and take for granted the truth of constant change. So we can't fix our analysis on 1848 or 1871 or 1917 or 1959 or 1968 or 1989. Instead, we have to be able to adapt our understanding, adapt our theories and methods, and be able to confront reality as it really is. Marx rightly never wavered from Hegel's sort of main truth that real is rational and that the rational is real. So it's how we rationalize ourselves and our actions that can produce something real. But otherwise, it doesn't really mean a thing. So that's sort of why I'm calling this podcast The Sensible Socialist. Because we can be socialists and communists and anarchists. Quick definition. Anarchists usually agree with Marx and a lot of people on the critique of capitalism and the problem of property and things like that, but really find whatever state-based solutions people come up with problematic for all sorts of different reasons. And we'll have an episode on anarchism. But that socialist, communist, anarchist, Marxist can still be sensible people. And we can take the world for what it is and not just what we wish it would be or not just what we believe it to be. So we really can be sensible socialists, and we have to be. So, all right. That about does it for me. I think this episode, look, I bet this episode was a bit boring, and if you made it this way, I do really appreciate it. But it's going to be really helpful when people misunderstand or that, you know, they take things for granted. And I can always hopefully point back to such and such a part of the definitions episode so that you can know that we might be speaking past each other a little bit. Look, if you agree with my definitions, cool. If you disagree with my definitions, tell me. You can find me on social media. Just look for Sensible Socialist. My Twitter is Sensible Social One, but I actually said that my birthday was 2018, so now it locked me until I have to, like, send them something, or I don't know. And so otherwise, you could just go old school. Send me an email, sensiblesocialistpodcast@gmail.com. And, you know, if we have some disagreement and some interesting things, let's have a follow-up episode and we can talk about it. You can also comment down below and let me know what you think. But until then, thanks for listening and see you next time.
I mean, the core notion of at least traditional socialism is that what you mentioned, that working people have to be in control of production and communities have to be in control of their own lives and so on. And you know, the Soviet Union is the exact opposite of that. The working people had no control over anything. They were virtual slaves. And the collapse of the Soviet Union is in fact a small victory for socialism, in my opinion. It eliminated one of the major barriers to it and should have been recognized as such. But the term has been, as I said, become so meaningless that it's hard even to use. If we use it in the traditional sense, which you brought up, that goes straight back in American history.
That's what I'm trying to get at. The Republican Attack Act against you in a general election, it writes itself. You supported the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, you honeymooned in the Soviet Union, and just this weekend you said you're not a capitalist. Doesn't that ad write itself?
Well, first of all, let's look at the facts. The facts that are very simple. Republicans win when there is a low voter turnout, and that is what happened last November. 63% of the American people didn't vote, Anderson. 80% of young people didn't vote. We are bringing out huge turnouts and creating excitement all over this country. Democrats, if the White House on down, will win when there is excitement and a large voter turnout. And that is what this campaign is doing.
You don't consider yourself a capitalist, though.
Do I consider myself part of the casino capitalist process by which so few have so much and so many have so little, by which Wall Street, greed and recklessness wreck this economy? No, I don't. I believe in a society where all people do well, not just a handful of billionaires.